Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about a surprise fine coming out of FINRA, who owns your banking data, and something you definitely should not do at your tech or FinTech, or actually any company that you might be at. Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get going. So this week is a bit of a mix of different stories. So we're going to hit you with a little bit of everything this week.
It's a Christmas potpourri, if you will.
That's right. And your present is to have Steve joining us this week.
Merry Christmas.
That's right. I hope that's not the only thing you get.
Yes.
All right. So we have a range here, but let's start off with the lump of coal first. Who's that going to?
Oh, God. I guess the folks over at Robinhood get another lump of coal this year is from regulators. So FINRA, which is an SRO, a self-regulating organization, fined Robinhood $1.25 million.
Which isn't a big amount.
It's not a huge fine. It's not the $5 billion.
For a broker-dealer, it's not big. I mean, maybe for you personally.
For me, it would be for sure. Yeah, for me, it would be. But it's not for a well-funded startup. The FINRA fine here claims that Robinhood, and this is, of course, based on historical data they claim from maybe 2 years ago, but they were not getting the best deals on their orders for customers. So
they weren't making their best execution.
Exactly. So say that you want to buy Apple share, or now, as of today, you can buy a fractional share. So say you want to buy a tenth of an Apple share. Robinhood was not getting you the best price they possibly could, so that we're not executing the deal on your, you know, with your best interest in mind.
And just to be technical, this is Rule 5310, execution quality factors.
My favorite rule.
Such as price movement.
Yeah.
That they weren't quite living up to. And the good thing for Robinhood out of this is that they did it without admitting or denying any wrongdoing.
Of course. Here's my fine.
Which means you have lawyers working on your side.
Here's my fine. Here's my money. By the way, I didn't really do this. It's not really my fault.
And this is during the 2016-2017 timeframe. So, of course, now Robinhood is saying, well, these are problems in the past, and we've improved everything, and everything's good to go now. So, well, we'll see if they live up to that.
We'll see. I think it also...
We'll talk about it in the next story where they get violated or some violation in 2020.
When they get their next fine. This may be a case of maybe Robinhood, because they're so prominent, getting a lot of attention for this, and this could happen very frequently for all that we know for other broker-dealers, but it seems to happen a lot with Robinhood.
Yeah. All right. Or they maybe to just get the most press out of it. Or they get more attention.
Yeah.
It's like some other places we know.
Any press. Any press.
Seem to attract the negative press.
Yeah.
So when you're doing your banking and financial transactions on your mobile, on the website, or going to a branch, who owns that banking data?
I presume I own that data, no?
No, you would presume kind of wrong. Mostly wrong.
Mostly wrong, okay.
But mostly dead.
But
just go through the pockets and get your change.
Yeah.
Apparently that's what some banks are doing anyway. They're kind of fighting to keep that walled, keep you within their walls, right?
It is. So this is the story regarding the fact that now if you're a PNC customer, like I used to be actually, I got my mortgage, my first mortgage to PNC in DC.
They're mostly on the East Coast. I've never seen them on the West Coast.
I think they're based in Pittsburgh, thus the name PNC.
Uh-huh.
If you are a customer of PNC and you want to link your Venmo account to your PNC bank, sorry, can't do it. The bank says they will not share data with Venmo, even via an API, and they are now encouraging people on social media to basically go to Zelle, which is the Venmo alternative that all the banks have.
So I guess, is it PNC is not allowing anybody? They have this particular fight with Venmo, but it sounds like their policy is across the board.
It's across the board, yeah. Any sort of data scrapers, any, you know, your Yodlee and Plaids of the world will not be able to connect to your PNC account, which I think is a pretty terrible experience. And if you look at the macro picture of this, right, everyone's using all these third-party services to connect their stuff, right? Everyone's connecting their accounts and scraping data and creating a better experience. But this is, I think, a symptom of the fact that we don't have a good framework like they do in the UK. In the UK, you have a thing called open banking, where you can basically, you know, the argument is sort of like how you're able to transfer your number from, say, Verizon to Sprint.
Your phone number.
Your phone number, right? You can easily port that number over. In the UK, you can do the same with your bank account.
I wish I could just take my bank account number from right. one bank to and the just, other. Just keep
that, yeah, if you remember it, absolutely.
Now
yeah.
I have to remember a new bank account number.
My routing number is such okay. emotional attachment to my routing number.
Yeah. Well, okay, that's lesser importance than the data, sure. So right now there's no way in the U.S. to kind of just take all your information with you.
There's absolutely no way to port your data over now. You can go through a third-party service provider, like, you know, again, the Yodlys and Plaids of the world.
Yeah, I didn't know data. Plaid. Well, I guess we've talked about it a bit, but it really points out how Plaid is kind of like the big middleware between banks and tech companies. Because they point out how Plaid is that main interface for Coinbase, for Venmo, for...
I think they're Square. They do
must be hundreds yeah. and maybe thousands of different tech companies, and for sure then on the banking side. But I didn't notice how we've done away with that old version of connecting to your bank, which is like I'm sure most people remember you have to send like a 2 cents or 3 cent transaction.
Yeah.
Verify that went through.
I think it's 4 cents. Yeah, and it takes I think up to 4 business days, which is a horrible yeah. There would experience. Be
I mean now it's so
now
convenient.
It seems like it's so, yeah.
But yeah, there used to be this whole long relatively long. It's not that big a deal, but this whole process I hadn't noticed. I hadn't done that in ages,
right? Now because
Plaid and others like them provide this kind of automated secure service, and and everybody else seems to not have a problem with this the security and everything. So is PNC kind of making this making up this issue about security just so they could keep people within the PNC world? Because one thing that looks very suspicious is that they suggest that people use Zelle instead.
Well, yes, but I think that from PNC's perspective, they're just kind of holding on to the fact that they can control the user's data. But really, if you look at all the news reports, they're getting really beaten up over this. It seems like this is the last holdout of banks not giving up that data, which, again, if you're in the UK for the past, I think, 5 years or so, you can do fairly easily with this open banking concept.
Right, right. And I like the way they phrase it in the article is they're holding data hostage.
Exactly. It's right? my data and I want to pay with Venmo. I don't want to use Zelle for whatever
and there's
reason.
No law to force me to have to cooperate with other financial institutions.
Yeah.
But as Venmo fighting back on Twitter is saying, they're saying, hey, tweet PNC, let me use the financial service apps I need.
By the way, Zelle actually is a much superior product of Venmo in many ways. You can claw back money on Zelle. Transfers takes much less time. It's just they have kind of a crappy UX. Other than that, I think that it's pretty comparable to Venmo. It's just it doesn't have the emojis and the social component that everyone likes with Venmo.
Yeah.
So again, I think people are kind of shunning.
It's a bank product.
It's a bank product.
Emojis. Keep that on.
Keep it on Square and Venmo. but it's still a very functional product. But it's just that people just want to use their Venmo because their friends are there and they. Use it already.
Right, so. Right. It's a matter of choice, not...
And so one last point also is that I think Zelle actually has exceeded Venmo in transaction volume over the past 2 quarters or so.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a massive product.
But Venmo is just one of many different products. So.
Well, Venmo, PayPal, Square Cash, right? They all have the same kind of functionality. So.
Yeah. So Zelle might overtake Venmo, but in the overall market, they're still one of many players, yeah?
Correct.
There's nobody... completely dominating yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Interesting. Let's see what happens. But I hope PNC loses this one. Okay. Just a quick note on a rule change coming out of the FDIC to make it, that makes it a little bit easier for smaller banks to work with tech companies. They made a change on what they consider core deposits. This may get a little bit technical. I used to calculate core deposits at a small bank I worked at a long time ago when I still had to do math.
Nice.
Anyways, there's some banks that specialize just on providing services for tech companies or fintechs. One of them is called Green Dot. They work with Apple, for example, on Apple Cash. And they have They're kind of focused, and they have a little bit higher costs because all of their deposits are considered brokered or hot money. Not they're regular depositors, but they're coming from outside of the organization.
Can you explain hot money for our users?
Hot money. Yeah. So hot money is considered deposits, I should say, that it's very volatile. So they're subject to leave much more quickly and easily, especially if there's some kind of financial or economic issues going on. And your core deposits are those that are pretty much expected to stay stable. So let's say at a bank, it could be like 60, 70% core deposits. Those aren't going to go anywhere for almost no reason.
Yep.
So these broker deposits or hot money have different rules, and they have higher insurance costs from the FDIC. So a company like Green Dot is specialized to thread that regulatory needle and make sure they comply with everything because of this hot money. But the FDIC is making what I think is a very common sense move. They're differentiating that kind of tech money coming in versus money that's brokered from an outside broker that would bring that money in, and it could come in and out. So a tech company is not like a financial institution broker or anything like that.
Right.
They're just providing a service. And that can be a very stable service, so it could behave like a core deposit. And that's what the FDIC is addressing with this rule change. So it'll make it a little bit easier for smaller banks to compete, because they won't need all these special compliance and higher costs to provide deposit services for partners like our beloved fintechs. So yeah, an interesting change, and one of the many things that we see kind of edging those barriers of entry away, that's going to make it more and more difficult and more competition for the incumbent financial institutions.
Speaking of the process, John, if you think of high finance in New York City, you think of, say, you know, Lexington Avenue between 50th and 42nd Street, or maybe Wall Street, sort of the downtown area.
Oh, you really have that geography down.
It's really down. I used to work in that area. But you're not thinking of, say, you know, Fort Lee, New Jersey.
I think about Fort Lee, New Jersey all the time.
Why?
No particular reason.
No particular reason. There's an amazing article that just came out recently detailing the journey of this bank called Cross River in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And what they do is that they're basically one of those banks that provide the FDIC-insured banking and
so the services we're just talking about.
Yeah. Exactly. They provide the services to enable all these fintechs to either lend money or do any sort of money movement. So one example in the article is that they are the ones behind both Prosper and Lending Club.
Are you saying they're the ones making money moves?
They're not the one making money moves. They're the ones that you basically have a company like Lending Club, which has their own, you know, underwriting algorithms, all the fancy stuff, big data, AI, whatever. But really, at the back end of that, it's a really old school bank with no branches, no tellers, no ATMs, just a bank in name only, because they have an FDIC insurance. And they're the ones through which all these funds go. So they kind of help all these fintechs who are, you know, unwilling or unable to get an FDIC insurance or a banking license, get over that by, again, providing that regulatory underpinnings.
Like a bank with a large compliance and technology department and very little of anything else.
Exactly. I think they have maybe about 150 employees or so, but they
overly paid executives.
And overpaid executives, of course. Yeah. But they, it's been in the news because they were really behind the surge that we saw post 2008 in terms of P2P lending, right? I remember when Lending Club's stock wasn't a joke and it was sort of, you know, pre-IPO, it was really, you know, this is going to change the way in which lending happens, whatever. And all that, all those funds came through Cross River Bank.
They did all the compliance, regulatory, and data connections for them.
Right. So companies like
so they Cabbage, could scale up quickly, which is nice.
They could, yeah. Funding Circle, Prosper, Lending Club, right? All these players in the UK and in the US. So one thing about this bank, they're actually underwriting loans at a pace of $1 billion a month.
Oh, so they're really driving this market.
They're driving this market, I think.
So they're Plaid and all these players that are kind of enabling fintech.
Plaid is different parts of it. Plaid is more of the middleware connector of it all.
Right. Not the same function, but enabling fintechs.
Enabling fintech, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Selling picks and shovels during the boom, right?
Sell picks and shovels.
Yeah. So there's this really interesting article in Forbes about how this company who, you know, began sort of underwriting a lot of the products for Upgrade and Upstart and Lending USA and Affirm and all these other sort of fintechs.
So what could go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong, right? What could go wrong is that they're actually going to they're getting to the limit of what they can hold, given the or the limit of what they should hold, given how much money is going through their books. They're just going through so much money, $30 billion in 9 years, which is a lot for a no-name bank. So the argument here is that, you know, if we do see some sort of collapse or cratering of the whole fintech boom, this bank would really be in trouble.
So they're not holding enough capital? Are they getting pounded by the regulators then?
They're not getting pounded yet, but they are getting they're getting there in terms of their upper limits, given their financial solvency and how much.
Yeah, well, this is like a key thing from the financial crisis is finding those systemically important banks and having a higher bar for them in terms of capital because of their importance. But there's a kind of like now there's this different definition of what's a systemically important bank.
Right.
Because middle players like this can disrupt a huge amount of or dozens of other related companies if they go down or if they have problems.
Correct, yeah. And
Is that what you're trying to say, Steve?
I think that's what I'm trying to say, yes. Okay. Thank you. One really good note here is that, you know, you see all these really amazing iPhone apps, so kind of the slick interfaces, but really behind it all, they're basically just companies hawking poorly underwritten lending products and using this bank as a platform for that.
Yeah, so they're not the ones that have to pay for the loan losses, right? They're just processing. So it's the tech company that's actually doing the kind of like the marketing arm.
Correct, yeah.
The one that's on the hook. All right, well, let's get to something that you should avoid at your next job.
Don't be an asshole boss.
That's
the golden rule.
You know, I keep telling them that, and they ignore me.
They do not listen.
An asshole would.
Yeah, they do not listen. So I think we've all heard by now about the away luggage story, right? The CEO was sort of a nightmare, and, you know, they would only communicate via Slack.
So even though, you were sitting right outside, she would just...
She would just Slack you, yeah.
What was her name?
Steph Curry, I think, which sounds like Steph Curry. Maybe it's not Steph Curry. I happen to not love Slack, but whatever, that's a different issue. But we've come across something very similar from a different company, sort of a fintech enabling company called Synapse.
In terms of like this toxic environment?
Exactly.
I mean, it wasn't just Slack didn't make it a toxic environment,
no,
by
it
the
wasn't,
way.
It was not,
there's
it was
a lot
Slack,
of other
yeah.
things.
I think Slack helped, yeah. So there's this really interesting story about a fintech startup here in the Bay Area. I think they're in SF, actually, in Oakland, called Synapse. Financial technologies, and what they do is that they help smaller fintechs, you know, issue debit cards, do the underwriting, kind of the same thing.
Okay,
that we all
well,
do,
this
right?
is like the enabler episode. Okay.
It is the enabler episode, but apparently they also enable a bunch of assholes because the CEO of this company is accused of mistreating a lot of his female employees to an extent that I haven't seen before, at least in fintech. So he's accused of, you know, kind of being a raging maniac, making sexual overtures towards his female employees. And I wonder, you know, we...
Has he heard of the Me Too thing?
I think, that's such a good question,
out
right?
There.
But I wonder, you know, I'm sure this happens a lot on Wall Street, but tech has had, for a past several years up until like 2 years ago, this sheen of like, you know, we're better than that, we're more inclusive culture, whatever. But I wonder whether the combination of finance and technology creates sort of the ultimate combo where just a bunch of people just behave like animals. I don't know.
I think there's just so many more fintechs that even if there's a 1% chance, now you have, you know, 5,000 fintechs, there's going to be a few. There's going to be a lot.
It's also it's a lot easier to publicize this stuff than it was 20 years ago. So maybe we're just, it's sort of like police violence, right? Like we see it a lot more now because cameras are more widespread.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that the same thing was happening 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a really sad story about a couple of women, three in a lawsuit now, and they're alleging everything from discrimination because one of them got pregnant and sort of had to come back right after giving birth, to again making this weird sexual overtures to them and just having a really horrendous workplace culture.
That is sad. If you just want to work, build your career, and then you have to deal with men.
If you just want to enable something awesome and they have to deal with a horrible boss, that's just not a good experience.
Yeah.
But I think that actually this really heartens me because I've seen a lot of stuff, again, with the away luggage stuff that we discussed and also with this company. It happened recently at Google where they fired somebody for posting a script on the internal Chrome server.
But a script?
There's a company out of Michigan. They allow employees to explore unionization. And this woman inserted a script on the internal Google, on the internal Chrome, to say that, hey, if you go to this website, by the way, you have a right to unionize, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
Saying that you are protected from looking into this. And she was fired because she was accused of manipulating internal programs and processes to push for review.
Huh.
So, yeah, this
is
happened
she,
like maybe 2 days ago.
Is she suing or anything?
She, of course, she's
up?
Suing. She's filing a thing with the National Labor Relations Board. It's part of the whole ongoing sort of Google against its employees saga that's going on recently. But we've seen a lot of these things sort of come to the surface, right? This three women's in a lawsuit now, the Google thing happening, a lot of protests at Apple and Salesforce. And it seems like there's kind of
worker and discrimination type of
over discrimination, over engaging in what the workers deem to be unethical.
Also, like military contracts as well.
ICE, right? So
just speaking up more.
Yeah. And I it's a horrible thing that happened to these three women, of course. But I do like that there's a lot more more attention being paid now to this, what I think is a pretty horrible problem in the industry.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good that these things come to light rather than, I mean, the problem is it's always been kept hidden and
yeah.
There's no ramifications. So.
Right. You sign all the NDAs. If you happen to enter into a settlement, you can't disclose the amount of what happened. Nobody ever admits the fault. So, yeah.
So it's the holiday times. Be nice to your employees and
be nice.
Coworkers.
Exactly. Be nice. Just don't be, it doesn't take a lot to not be an asshole.
I'll keep trying.
Yeah.
All right, now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it.
I have an awesome final bite, a really happy one, actually.
Wow, you always have an awesome final bite.
I always do.
I'm trying to be nicer. See?
Yes, it's working. my final bite is $2.3 billion.
Okay.
And that is how much Jamaicans sent back home in 2018 in remittances.
From worldwide or
from
just
worldwide.
From the U.S.?
So any Jamaicans living and not in Jamaica sent back $2.3 billion in remittances last year. Why is this a fintech story? Because Xoom, X-O-O-M, which is a PayPal company, now has a product that allows Jamaicans living, say, in the UK, the US, Australia, to pay for their relatives or whatever, you know, whoever it is, to pay for...
Mistresses, whoever,
their second families, to pay for their utility bills via an online
interface.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, so that if I say...
So they could do it directly.
They could do it directly. So that if, say, I leave and I go to the UK or something and I want to pay for my mom's cable bill or whatever, gas bill, I could do it from the UK directly and I'd have to incur a lot of fees. And from other sort of... I actually used to work in this field, and for a lot of the stuff that I've seen is that remittances, a lot of it goes to paying for things like, school tuition, your cell phone bill, and now this enables that to happen in a much more quick, cheap, and efficient way.
So Xoom has to make a deal with each utility, or not a deal, but figure out the connections for all of these?
I believe that's the case. They have to go on a one sort of one vendor, one merchant per merchant basis, which seems like it's fairly labor
intensive.
I guess
if there's one electric company for the whole, it's just
there
an island,
one.
Right?
Yeah,
and that's kind of a good
island.
Case to get coverage.
Yeah.
Not like having to cover 50 states or
exactly. Yeah.
Actually, more than that because
of
all the sub utilities and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also interesting because Jamaica is a really interesting market for this because they're not the biggest recipient of remittances in the world. That would be,
is it the Philippines?
It's probably the Philippines or Mexico. I think they're
probably
kind of head-to-head.
One of the two. Yeah,
it's one of the two. But they still have they still have one of the highest rates of remittance of receiving remittances in the world.
All right, my final bite is 60%, and that's the time that it takes data scientists at J.P. Morgan and I think generally to identify and pool relevant data to train their AI models.
So you're not actually training the model, you're just sort of getting data to train the model.
Right, so most of your time, I think at least 60%, because it's such a hassle to pull out data, to make sure it's the right format.
Yeah, standardize it, format it in the way that it makes sense. Yeah,
and get just the right data is such a hassle. So they've been working on a way to automate that process with, of course, AI. So JP Morgan has this product called Omni AI that's trying to get relevant data out of their huge amounts of data. I mean, this is JP Morgan Chase. They do about $6 trillion worth of payments daily.
Jesus.
And they estimate that about 50% of U.S. households have some kind of relationship with JP Morgan Chase. So if you want big data outside of China, this is a really good example of that. So they're working on pulling out what they call minimum viable data, so the best candidates for the specific function.
Yep.
And they have certain use cases that they're initiating this in. They have 12 or so that they're starting off with to do things like identify travel, entertainment expenses for that management, identifying relevant customers for products where they may be getting charged too much or using the wrong product, that sort of thing. So the big plus, I think if you work at a bank, one of the things you'll notice right away from this article, and this is in Forbes magazine, is that they mentioned that Omni AI, the product, is designed with the regulations and privacy and data rules kind of baked into this process.
All the good stuff in the process.
Yeah, so when they pull the relevant data from their massive data warehouses, it's already taking into account the kind of data that they should and shouldn't be having access to based on regulatory and all the relevant rules, which, yeah, if you work at a bank, that's a big...
That's huge.
Yeah, so automating that away in I'm sure they have thousands of rules baked into this thing is a huge benefit.
That's really interesting. I wonder whether they actually will license this stuff or whether they just keep it in-house and increase their efficiency.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It'd be a great fintech on its own.
It'd be an amazing fintech, yeah.
But JP Morgan might be seeing it as a competitive advantage,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, makes sense.
So I think down the line, not just JP Morgan, but the industry sees AI as coming to help in a lot of different areas, including getting more people access to financial products that they may not have had access to because they're in a certain pool. Helping people build their retirement savings with automated queues and goals that will work for them on an individual, tailored, personalized basis, and just a ton of applications that the AI could be helpful for. Well, enjoy your holidays, and by hitting subscribe to the FinTech Newscast, and we'll see you in 2020. Thanks for listening.
Happy holidays.